Welcome to SDPB's Teacher Talk, where two teachers and a journalist explore what it means to choose teaching as a profession. I'm the journalist, Lori Walsh. Before we get to today's conversation, a little more about our Teacher Talk educators. Jackie Wilbur is a faculty member at the University of South Dakota and director of the Center for Student and Professional Services in the School of Education. She's been a teacher, a librarian, and an administrator. She's also an experienced registered yoga teacher. Gina Benz teaches at Roosevelt High School and helped develop the Teacher Pathway Program. She's adjunct faculty at the University of Sioux Falls and the University of South Dakota. Here's our conversation. We are gathered in Sioux Falls and Vermilion and are connected through the power of public broadcasting. Mm-hmm. Jackie Wilbur at the campus of University of South Dakota, welcome.
Thank you. I love public broadcasting.
Yay. How are things at USD?
It's a great start to the school year. Thanks.
Good. Good. Yeah. All right. Gina Benz is here in Sioux Falls after a long day at school and teaching, and welcome.
Thank you. I did have a very hard moment at school today when technology didn't cooperate with me. But the beauty of the moment was I turned around and my students were just chatting with each other. There wasn't a phone out there. They were just all enjoying each other and enjoying the moment until I could get it figured out.
That's the best thing. There's a book that's called Thank You for Being Late, which I have never read, but I like the title.
I like that.
And the premise of it is if you are waiting for somebody in a coffee date or whatever, there's some kind of delay, that you just get to use that time to be with your thoughts. Mm-hmm. And we have so few pockets of time. So that might have been the best part of their day, was when technology failed and they just got to thank you for being late.
Mm-hmm. Maybe. I hope so.
Yeah.
I hope so.
I love how they responded.
I do too. Yeah. They're the best.
That's nice. Mm-hmm. All right. Brain Science Matters. For classroom learning, Gina Benz, you wanted to dive into this because?
It is really fascinating to think about how our brain is structured and how it works and how that connects to the decisions we make every day as teachers. We really do need to know the brain science to be at our very best. And this really got me interested because this summer I was teaching a grad class at USF, and the book we read was talking a lot about brain science, and so I got a little bit obsessed.
And Jackie, this is an area of research for you as well.
Yes, brain scientists would not say so, but from the education standpoint, yeah, right. I would definitely say so. I got interested in it when I was working on my dissertation. There's just a lot of relationships between the stress response and brain science. So that's where my area of research and interest is at.
And I found this so fascinating, and it was one of those moments every once in a while we'll have like what I consider like a leap in my level of respect for teachers, for educators. And and this is one of them, where all of a sudden I sit in awe of what teaching actually is.
Thank you. Thank you.
We're going to get into more of that because I have some questions.
Good. Bring it on.
You're referencing Zaretta Hammond's work here that is about learning theory and brain science. Tell me a little bit about her, Gina.
She especially wants to make sure that all students are being challenged and that we aren't becoming overly sentimental or, I don't know if I'm saying this right, overly compassionate. I'm not saying we shouldn't be compassionate,
right,
but sometimes we can be overly compassionate where we then enable things and we don't require students to meet certain expectations. And so her work is a lot about the safety and the belonging kids need, but also the challenge that they need. And our brains need challenge to grow.
And if you don't encourage rigor or provide that kind of rigor, you're really selling your students short.
I used the word marginalize. And I totally mean that. I feel like you're marginalizing your students. You are giving them fewer options and opportunities in their life.
Yeah. Wow. Jackie, what would you add to that? Just this idea of, you know, if we want people to feel safe and secure in the classroom, we're going to get into some details here. Mm-hmm. But broadly speaking, you are preparing students to learn the next hard thing.
Absolutely. Challenge is key to growth. A very simple analogy is that your brain is a muscle. And so if you don't exercise it, if you don't have it lift weights, it won't get stronger. And so you do need the challenge of learning a new task, learning a new skill in order to flex the muscles of the brain and have it develop and get stronger.
I love that you made that analogy, because I am trying to see my classroom as a weight room this year.
Yeah. Love this.
As opposed to an obstacle course.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And the obstacle course idea is I've got all these hoops to jump through so I can get the grade I want.
Yeah.
As opposed to we're going to practice, we're going to work out, we're going to grow stronger.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I looked up an interview with Hammond, and one of the things she said is that the brain is a learning machine. You don't have to teach it to learn.
No.
That's what it does. That's what the brain does. But we can help enhance its ability to learn more quickly by improving its information processing. That kind of blew my mind. And it got me thinking back to all the ways I learned how to learn in school. And then, again, thinking about all the ways that has changed in the classroom, mm-hmm. probably from when I was in school. So let's talk about some of that. Because, Gina, in this blog post, which has links to some research, and you can find it at sdpb.org/teachertalk, you talk about the teacher's primary role and creating this productive struggle.
I love the term productive struggle.
Yeah.
Sometimes we say the zone of proximal development. Did I say that right, Jackie?
You did.
Good. Mm-hmm. And so the teachers have to find the sweet spot where a student has enough challenge, enough struggle that they will grow, but not so much challenge and struggle that they almost become paralyzed by the challenge. So there's a real science and art to that as teachers. We have to constantly be observing and making sure we're giving the right amount of challenge, because let's talk about esteem, self-esteem. Mm-hmm. Self-esteem does not come from, oh, you're so smart.
Yeah.
No, self-esteem comes from having a challenge and meeting that challenge. That's where real self-esteem comes from. And so if we are not giving our students these challenges, we're depriving them of, I think actually her book says, if we don't give them challenges that are appropriate, we deprive them of a dopamine hit.
Yeah.
I don't know. That resonated with me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We get a dopamine hit because when we learn to do hard things, that's a positive brain chemical is released.
There it is. Yeah. It's actual brain science.
Yeah.
And so I think when we talk about self-esteem, let's remember it has to do with being presented with a challenge and meeting that challenge.
Yeah. Jackie, what would you add to that, that idea of productive struggle? Mm-hmm. How would a first-year teacher who's really trying to manage everything that a first-year teacher has to manage consider the idea of productive struggle or the zone of proximal development?
Yeah, I like to see myself in the zone of proximal development while I'm seeing my students there, right? Especially first-year teachers, I think that's a good way to reframe things, is that you are doing this too, right?
Yeah.
Carol Dweck, and I know I feel like I'm like her mindset minion, but I'm just really, really fascinated by her work, and she continues to write, and I continue to read about what she's doing. But the brain scans will show that when someone encounters a challenge, they either, if the challenge is too hard or they believe they can't meet the challenge, their brain will shrink in response and less of their neurons will fire, and the brain scan will show that it's not activated, right? And so that's what Gina's talking about. If you give a student more than they can handle, it's like giving them a weight that they can't pick up. They're not actually going to be able to exercise with that, right? They're not going to be able to do anything. Yeah. But when you encounter a challenge that is challenging, but you can grow to meet the challenge, brain scans show that more of the brain is illuminated as they try to expand their knowledge to figure out this new concept or idea. And new neurons will fire as they start to make connections and figure out the new skill.
Yeah. You mentioned in here that you have to point this out. Explicitly communicate the rewards that will come from learning and growth for the day. Gina, tell me about that. In what ways in a classroom do you explicitly communicate the rewards?
Okay. I say why we're doing what we're doing.
Okay.
One time, my principal was in the room evaluating me, observing me, and the evaluation came back and said, man, I've always thought commas were really boring, but you made me realize that they're pretty important. Because you talk about how just presenting yourself in writing in a professional way can create a favorable impression with the people you're communicating with. And if you present yourself in writing with a lot of errors, that's a negative impression.
Yeah.
And so I say things like, this is important in the workplace. This will be important in college. This will help us when we get to our next unit. Mm-hmm. And then the biggest thing is that, especially when we read literature, this will make us better for society and for ourselves.
Yeah. So this is a weird analogy, but when I was in basic training in the Marine Corps, one of the things you have to do is always sit with your, you know, kind of cross legs on the floor, and they would always say left hand, left knee, right hand, right knee. So you would sit down and everybody would sit in the exact same way. And it would get uncomfortable, and you would sit there for a long time, and you get kind of stiff, even at a young age. And one time an older recruit told me, like in the, I don't even remember how, because we had like no contact with anybody else. And she said, you know why you do that? It's because when you go to the rifle range, that's a position you're going to need to be comfortable in it for a long time. And immediately I was like, oh, there's a reward coming. This isn't just so much in boot camp is just dumb stuff, you know, like it's just stuff to prove that you will obey things. So the Marine Corps is nothing like a classroom, except when it is. And that was one of the times when it was like, oh, we're in this physical position because a month from now, we're going to need to be holding a rifle and leaning over in this exact physical position for hours at a time.
That's a perfect analogy.
By the time we got there, it was a piece of cake. You had that position down.
I feel like they were trying to do it in a Karate Kid kind of way.
Yeah.
Where it's like, you've been doing this the whole time.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean?
Oh, I love that.
I love that. I thought they were just trying to save space. So, like, we all looked the same. We all fit in the room, you know.
Right.
But there was another purpose to it. And it was when somebody explicitly explained to me the purpose that, for me, was like, oh, okay, now I'm on board.
Yeah.
Before, it was just something I resisted.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's talk about it. Like, I don't know. Should we cut that out?
No.
It seems like a weird
No, that's a perfect analogy.
But I don't know that I got that kind of explicit instruction in school very much.
I think there, especially there was a time when it was, do as I said.
Memorize this.
Yeah. And it was just like, I'm the teacher. Do what I say. Yeah. I don't need to give you a reason.
Yeah.
The brain needs a reason in order for it to really engage.
It was motivation. It gave me the motivation to participate in the thing because I was like, oh, okay, that's kind of cool.
The alternative is that you are participating due to a threat or a perceived threat.
Right.
And that's when the inner parts of your brain kick in when you feel threatened and you move into this automatic state where that inner parts of the brain take over and learning can occur then.
Yeah. That's the other 95% of the Marine Corps. Okay. The brain has three layers, and all of these layers impact student learning. Let's go through these, Gina, and start with the reptilian region.
This is where all the automatic stuff happens.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to think about breathing. You can, which is a pretty cool thing, that we can think about it and control it, but we don't have to. And I remember Jackie taught me that we can be really thankful to our bodies that we have that, where it will take care of us, but if we need it, we can also take control of it. Anyhow,
she's really wise.
She's the best. Just the best.
Thank you.
So anyhow, that's all the automatic stuff. And again, if there's danger or perceived danger, then it's going to take over. And the other parts of the brain are going to shut down so it can take over and keep you safe.
So how do you create classrooms that feel physically, socially, and emotionally safe for all your students?
One thing that I have always tried to keep in mind is that I can't tell someone else what feels safe to them, right? I can't say this is a safe room, believe me, right? Some people have heard that before in that exact way, and it's been very untrue, right? So I think allowing students to have the autonomy and the power to say, I feel unsafe or I will be more comfortable this way. Because as Gina said in her blog, one of the main things that Zaretta Hammond's work is saying is to move from dependence to independence. So if I'm constantly telling a student, this is what safety looks like, and I'm dictating that to them, they may not then develop the independence to be able to recognize safety on their own. And they've had all these different experiences, right, that I most likely haven't had or have had some of. And so they're coming at the world from a different place. So longer-winded answer than I meant to is just acknowledge that everyone is coming into this room from a different place. Yeah. Safety looks different for all of us, and that acknowledging that piece will help us kind of come up with some shared norms and procedures that's going to work for everyone. And so some classrooms have different classroom norms, because if you create them together, the different needs will get met.
Yeah.
Okay. I like that. And then I'll just add to it, the two words I would say that guide my focus on keeping things safe in the classroom is compassion and care. Mm-hmm. And I just show the kids that I care and that I have compassion for who they are. And that's by noticing that they're wearing a Metallica t-shirt and saying, oh my goodness, what's your favorite song? Yeah. Or noticing that they keep wearing a Bears jersey and I'm like, oh, I'm so sorry. You keep losing.
You had a bad Sunday.
Yeah.
Welcome to Monday.
And it's those inroads that are made that show I care, which create stronger connections over time.
And I wonder, I watched this beautiful video of the school district about you and you're in your classroom, and you have a large wall that you've talked about on this show before, with photographs, all the senior pictures and invites and like all these hundreds and hundreds of students. Mm-hmm. And you say in the video, like, if you point to a student, I can tell you a story about them. Mm-hmm. I can tell you something about them. Some names you might, you know, forget the name because there's hundreds of them, but you know them. Is that a way of creating a sense of social safety for the new students who come in? Because even if they don't fit in with their peers, they know this teacher is going to remember them.
Yeah, actually, as Retta Hammond says in her book, she spends a little time talking about how you have to think about the environment that you're creating in your classroom.
Yeah.
And as much as possible, it should reflect the students you have. Mm-hmm. And my grad students were like, oh, I'd been thinking about my classroom and I wanted it to reflect who I was so I could share myself with my students. And so, you know, I love Star Wars and fantasy and I was going to put Star Wars stuff up, which is great. Yeah, that's great. But also the room should reflect the students who are doing the learning in there. So that's part of the purpose of the pictures. It's also a quick way for my students to see, this woman is going to care about me, I think, before I can act. It takes time to show that care to all 120 students I have. Right. Mm-hmm. So
plus you're also communicating, you will get to graduation.
Mm-hmm.
You will get to the job, the military career, the college, the tech school of your choice, because here they all are.
Yeah. Like you will be this person.
You will be this person. Mm-hmm. And this person is a graduate
of
Roosevelt High School in your case.
Yeah.
I love that.
Jackie? Gina, I do want to just add to what you're saying. It's not as though you are practicing caring for your students. You are caring for your students.
Thank you. Yeah.
And I think you. That's something wise. I will just hear people say, well, I asked them about their Metallica shirt. Well, did you actually care about it? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because if you just, they can smell that inauthentic behavior from a long way away. And so it's not enough to show care. You need to actually care about them, which you do.
I do. I just love people's stories. English teacher. And so I think it comes naturally. I just kind of want to delve in to hear what the stories are. How did you get interested in Metallica? You were born in 2007.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So we talked about the reptilian region and now the limbic region. What is that?
This is where we process things. Mm. We can process emotions. We can hold memories. And it also, like the reptilian part, is essential for survival because you have to be able to interpret the things that you're seeing. And so it moves a little bit beyond that automatic response, but it's not yet the learning area of the brain.
So is this the part where Zaretta Hammond is saying, you know, everybody comes in with a culture. They come in with context.
Yeah.
They come in with an experience. They come in with memories.
You got it.
Right? So like if you've, you know, I just remember field trips in kindergarten at my daughter's school, and like they went to the breadsmith and watched them make bread. And that was a way to like help them understand where food comes from, because not all of them had ever had an experience. Like maybe they didn't know where bread comes from, because you just get it from the local grocery store and it's wrapped up in a plastic bag. So if all those students come to first grade and they know where bread comes from because they all went on the same field trip, you have created a culture in the school, right? Am I getting it?
It is a little bit more related to genetics. It has some, these traits in the limbic system can be passed down because it is also related to survival. So this is like the idea that culturally for generations, X happened. And so you might have like a sense of something being poisonous because it's a certain color if you live in a certain part of the world. And you maybe wouldn't even need to have been expressly told that, but there is an inherited memory of that in your lineage. So
that's fascinating.
Yes. And that is part of it.
It's also essential for survival.
It is also essential for survival. And then on a more present level, if you've had an experience with blank, right, like to continue this poisonous idea, if you ate something that was a certain color and had got an upset stomach, you now carry that memory with you, right? And so as part of your survival going forward, you're suspicious of things that are colored a certain way.
Okay.
And so keeping that in mind as you're interacting with students, sometimes they have a strong reaction to something, right? And you're like, I have no idea where that's coming from. Well, that's because they have these stored memories and emotions in that area of their brain that is helping them stay, you know, helping them with their survival.
Okay, so I'm not going to know that. But how do I respond to it as an educator?
Right, with compassion
and
care.
I can't do a quiz when I come in
and,
you know, get all these little things out of their brain.
Yes.
So then I respond with compassion and care.
Yes.
Compassion, care, connection.
Okay. 100%. Okay. I think that that's also something that when you have all of this knowledge, then you think, oh, I'm going to try to get it all perfect before I have any of these interactions. Well, it's still people, right? So you're still having these like imperfect encounters all the time. And then you can repair them because you care about them. And you say, I didn't mean to upset you in this way, and I am so sorry, and I won't do that again. And what do you need for me to move forward?
And you don't let them free from what the challenge was.
Right.
That you still need to stretch them and help them grow. You might adjust things a little bit, but they still need the challenge.
But it has to be a productive struggle.
Perfect.
I love it. I'm learning. Okay. Neocortex region. Jackie, you want to take this one? The analysis, self-regulation, organization.
Yes.
What's happening here?
Yes. So this is, I've talked before about the stress response. And so when you're in a state of flow or relaxation or ease, this is the part of your brain that's going to be more illuminated, right? This is where you are going to be able to have complex thoughts and to, you know, do the actual learning. This is where your brain will live. So the brain scans I was talking about, you're going to be illuminating this part of your brain when you are thinking in complicated ways. And so that's where we're trying to help students put their mindset when they're learning.
Yeah. And the more we review with students and help and have them repeat things and practice things, the neurons are developing pathways. And those pathways get, we could say, deeper and deeper or clearer and clearer. You know, I think about I'm a country girl. I grew up in the country. I think about a pathway that as more and more cars go over it, it's clearer that there's a pathway there.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. Nice.
That is a great analogy.
That is
how the brain
analogy.
Works.
Yeah. Now, I have some questions that I don't quite know how to answer, so I'm asking you.
We'll
so
try.
So when Zaretta Hammond talks about creating efficiency and learning, like the brain is wired to learn. When you're teaching something, in the interview I saw her, she was talking about like you're teaching a discipline, yes. You know, they need to learn the comma. But what they really need to learn is how to learn the comma, like the ways in which they learn. Help me understand what she means by that.
So with a comma, I think students start out, we call this scaffolding. So you start out at a simpler level and you slowly build on that.
Mm-hmm.
And so you might start out with that idea of where there's a pause, you might need a comma.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, we can build on if you have a conjunction, you might need a comma, and then we can build on it. Well, you need to make sure you have two independent clauses. So we keep building on that. But how do we help them learn how to learn? It's the questioning. Like, do you have two independent clauses? You give them the questions that they should ask themselves.
Okay.
What are the right questions to ask?
Jackie, what would you add to that?
I also think it's similar, Lori, I feel like you tell us frequently how you work best, right? Like, oh, if I'm going to write something, I'm going to go about it this way, and this is why I don't like outlining. I'm just thinking about previous conversations,
yes.
Right?
Yes. Lori is a reverse outliner.
Yes, and that is you telling us how you learn best. And so that is what I think Zaretta Hammond is saying is like that knowing that about oneself is key to learning, because you can say, oh, I understand the purpose of outlines, but this is the way that I need to use them in order to optimize the purpose of an outline, right? Mm-hmm. And so something like a comma is a little bit, that's not as complex of a project that a student would be working on, sure. right? This is how this grammatical rule functions. But if I need to study for a test that's going to test me on my knowledge for commas, how am I going to best retain this knowledge? Do I need to read the book again? Do I need to reread my notes? Do I need to go visit with a friend? Do I need to do more practice? And those are the questions that students need to be, and teachers can help them build that skill of how do you learn best. Yeah.
She also says the student is the unit of change. And that just rings a little bell inside my head. The student is the unit of change.
What did it mean to you?
Well, it's on my list of questions for you. It means to me the sense of like the teacher, I cannot learn this for you. Yeah. I can provide the information. I can help you become more efficient in your learning. I can look at your even neurodivergence and figure out different ways that I can connect you with the resources that will help you process this. Like, okay, I see this student who is reverse outlining. Maybe that's just how her brain works, or maybe I can present this other thing. I think you, Gina, said, like being in the Google Doc with, or being in the document with you, mm-hmm. and like following along. And I was like, oh, that would have been really helpful, because part of what was happening with that for me was not wanting to be embarrassed, like doing it wrong. But I was a very natural writer. So I was like, oh, okay, I can reverse outline this. But if you were in there with me, I might also learn another way of getting to the end point.
Yeah.
But as the student, I'm the one who's going to make that decision. You don't have to do it for me.
Yeah, so we have to take on the role of... Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, we have to take on the role of mentor or coach. My son plays basketball, and the coach has an area where he can walk around, walk back and forth, and coach his players on the court during the game. But he can't jump on the court mm-hmm. and play with them and shoot the basket.
Yeah.
And so we have to stay within boundaries mm-hmm. as they play the game.
A great analogy. Today is analogy day on Teacher Talk.
Yes.
Jackie, what would you add to this? Like, you know, the student is the unit of change. How do you teach teachers to allow for that to happen without being too hands off?
I just feel like students will change every day. It happens to you as the teacher. You don't get a choice in that. They are the unit of change. They are not the same day to day. Who they were yesterday is a person that is gone now, you know? And so I love that about students. But I would say that that's what it meant to me was I think of it more of just a statement of fact that they are growing fast. It is a day to day evolution because of their age.
I think part of it is because I come at it as a parent.
Mm-hmm.
That feels also liberating to me too.
Mm-hmm.
To just be like, oh yeah, I have to stay in my little box. I have to stay in the coach's box.
Ultimately,
to learn for parents sometimes.
Yeah.
Maybe other parents got it right away. It took me a while. I'm not gonna lie, it took me a while to figure out where that box was. I was all over the court.
No, I totally get it. Because
I'll take the ball to the net for you, kid.
For 9 months, they literally are an extension of you. They are connected to you.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
And then as they grow, they have all of that dependence on you. But our job, as Jackie already mentioned, is to go from dependence to independence.
Yeah.
And this is why parents might first rock their kids to sleep. And then they do maybe, you know, okay, I'll check on you after five minutes. And then... you keep moving until the kid can go to bed by him or herself, right?
Yeah.
You just dependence to independence.
Yeah.
Well, and this is also what I was starting to say at the very beginning, which is that this is also happening for you too. Your brain is doing, so you were in charge of the survival. You were the sole reason a baby was surviving, right? And then you were wired for survival too, right? And then now as your child moves into these more complex stages of learning, you're doing the same thing, right?
I must have done all right. I have a very independent child.
Oh, you did.
Yes. You've done something right.
You're an inspiration.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that struck me, and I don't want to veer into the political arena, but I want to go back to the very beginning about safety and social security, or, you know, being secure socially or feeling safe in a social environment. I'm wondering if one of the things that is becoming so difficult about public education is that in our family units, we are not feeling socially secure next to somebody who has a, you know, a pride flag and a mega hat, to use a really cliched example. But sometimes if you aren't willing to send your kid to a classroom where they might be exposed to somebody else's point of view, then parents are becoming and families are becoming less tolerant of that, and therefore more likely to say, I'm just going to get my kid out of that environment, or I'm going to try to control that environment so they don't hear this, that, or the other thing. And that's creating a cultural tension in the classroom. Am I wrong about that?
You're not wrong at all. And I say again and again, in this classroom, because I teach literature to upperclassmen, the literature can bring up interesting questions no matter what you read.
Right.
No matter if it's Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, it doesn't matter. And so the interesting conversations, I always have to preface it with, we may have different perspectives on this, but you can never argue your perspective well if you haven't listened to the other perspective. And so we will hear each other and we will learn from each other. And we can do this in a very peaceful way. Yeah. It doesn't have to be contentious because we're all in this together. We're all just trying to learn.
Yeah, we're all just trying to learn. Jackie, what would you add?
I think in a public school, you really encounter the public in a way that you don't encounter the public in the rest of your life. And I don't know how to explain that more succinctly than the public school is the whole public. Everyone goes there. And so any issues that exist in the public exist in the school. And that is something that I also think people are not aware of. If hunger is a problem in the public, you know hungry children.
Yeah.
You know? And so that is part of being an educator, is you see the problems that exist in our society in actual children.
I'm going to take a deep breath after that.
It's just so true. The public school educators out there are all nodding their heads right now.
Yeah.
And you see the things that are going well in society in actual children, too. It's all because you see everyone.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we serve everyone.
Yeah.
We serve everyone. We give kids transportation to school. Kids get food from your public schools. Kids sometimes have their clothes washed at their public school. Mm. We are here to serve. I mean, if you want to get biblical, the least of these.
Mm. And to not marginalize the least of these, to say in public school, we will help you meet all the challenges so you have all the options we can possibly put in front of you for your learning machine that is your brain.
That's the goal, right? It is supposed to be the great equalizer. And to what degree we uphold that ideal, I think, is debatable. But it is the goal. It is the effort. Is to say, if you come here, we're going to help you figure out your way to the next thing. And we will teach you what you need to know.
And that is good for all of society, every single person. I've said this on a previous episode, because when people don't have education, we know this, because in prisons there's a ton of high school dropouts. When people don't have education, don't have more options and opportunities in their life, don't have the hope that education provides, they become desperate. And desperate people do desperate things.
Yeah. This was what a generative column you have written, Ms. Benz.
I only want to become better at this. This was just like surface level, because I am no expert, but I am really curious. And ultimately, that's the teacher's job. Yeah. Is to provide information and inspire curiosity. And Zaretta Hammond has done that for me.
Yeah. All right.
I also found it to be incredibly helpful to share this type of information to my students, because if the goal is to help them figure out the best ways that they learn, telling them that is a good way to get started, right? Yeah. And so sharing information about brain science so that way they can start to sense their own brain working and what parts are illuminating and why and when is a really good way for them to learn about themselves and the ways they learn best.
This is good for you if you are in a nursing home.
You're right.
The way that you learn the new thing, this is good for you if you are in the workplace.
Yeah.
Yeah. The figuring out how that lifelong learning, it's still useful after all these years. Yeah. Thank you all, both.
Thank you, Lori.
I love our time together.
I do, too.
Same.
Here's one more Teacher Talk update. NPR CEO Catherine Maher was recently on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, and SDPB got a particular mention. Take a listen.
We know the major NPR shows, they get shared among the stations, and but there are lots of local shows that only address that.
Yes.
I love this.
What do you got?
Down in South Carolina, I always enjoyed Dr. Walter Edgar's Journal and South Carolina A to Z, like facts about South Carolina. South Dakota Public Radio has Teacher Talk, podcast about teachers talking about their jobs and giving advice to fellow educators. I love Vermont Public Radio's But Why?
I don't know.
That's a program that answers kids' questions.
If you enjoy SDPB's Teacher Talk, tell your BFAW, that is your best friend at work, tell your administrator, tell the next generation of educators that this is a place to learn about the highs and, yes, the lows of the profession from people who love what they do. You can share, like, and rate the podcast. That helps us find our place in today's crowded audio ecosystem. Teacher Talk airs on SDPB's In the Moment Tuesdays. You can find all the companion blogs with links to the research on our website, sdpb.org/teachertalk, or just click through the podcast feed to get to our episode webpage. We are produced by SDPB's In the Moment team, Ari Youngeman, Emily Kester. Our engineer is Colton Nicholson, Regina Benz, and Jackie Wilbur. I'm Lori Walsh. Thanks for listening.